The subject of man's thought power is, therefore, one of very great interest and importance. What has theosophy to say about the mystery of man's mind and his mental powers? It says a great deal which is well worthy of our close attention and study. At the very outset, an interesting, not to say arresting, idea is presented. Theosophy states that not only do supersensory powers such as telepathy and clairvoyance exist, but that they can be developed by means of a special kind of self-training. Furthermore, these methods have long been employed by advanced students who have acquired the faculty to observe direct the operation of the human mind, to see on thought waves, one might say, much as we normally see on light waves. What is the result of seeing on thought waves? In the main, at its own level, thought is found to produce four major effects. Two of these are upon the mind of the thinker and the thinker himself, and two others are outside of him. In this talk to you, I will go over these four in turn. The first effect of thought upon the mental body of the thinker, by the by, I'll define the mental body in a moment. The first effect of thought upon the mental body of the thinker is to change the person temporarily into the likeness of that upon which he thinks. His mental appearance and character are altered to make him look like the nature and subject of his thoughts. Ugly thoughts uglify, to use Lewis Carroll's words in Alice in Wonderland, chapter 9. Noble thoughts, on the other hand, ennoble, and beautiful thoughts beautify. The mental body and aura, now to be described, assume an appearance appropriate to the type of thought on which a person is engaged. What is this mental body of man? What does it look like under normal conditions? Well, examined by supersensory power and, as it were, on thought waves, the mental body of man is found to be composed of two parts, an inner, denser counterpart of the physical body, built of less tenuous material of the mental plane, and an interpenetrating and surrounding aura which is less dense. This aura of man is roughly egg-shaped, and about, shall we say, three times the size of the physical body, which it interpenetrates and surrounds. Brilliant luminous color is the chief characteristic of the human aura, and it is found that each color represents a mental power, a quality of character, or a habitual kind of thinking. The general color, for example, of intellectual activity is yellow. This is located in and around the head and is probably the origin of the nimbus or the halo. The power of love thought is rose-colored, of compassion a soft green. Anger shows as bright scarlet, and idealism is lavender, which last is generally situated in the upper portion of the aura, up above the head. When a person is strongly moved by love, desire or idealism, for example, the corresponding colors suffuse the aura, temporarily changing it into the likeness of that on which the person is thinking. We find this in our Bible, don't we, in the book of Proverbs, chapter 23, verse 7, where it says, "For as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." One finds the same idea in Eastern scriptures. What a man thinks on, he becomes. Think, therefore, on the eternal. George W. Russell, that great Irish seer and poet who is known as A.E., correctly stated the effect of thought upon the thinker in these words. "Race hatred," he wrote, "is the cheapest and basest of all national passions, and it is the nature of hatred, as it is the nature of love, to change us into the likeness of that which we contemplate." This is fully borne out by clairvoyant examination and theosophical teaching, based as that is upon direct observation of the processes of thought and their effect upon the thinker. Human thought force is indeed extremely powerful in the realm of mind, as telepathy and crowd psychology demonstrate. But it is also known, isn't it, that our thoughts can actually affect our physical body and its functions. The right use of thought power is important in the maintenance of one's health also. Well-controlled, harmonious, ordered thinking helps in achieving physical relaxation, nervous ease. Over-intense, excited, anxious, and fearful thoughts have the opposite effect. They produce nervous and muscular tensions and can interfere with both glandular balance and the glandular secretions, and so also the chemical composition of the blood. In that wonderful book which I recommend to you, Man the Unknown, Dr. Alexis Carroll writes, "Envy, hate, fear, when these sentiments are habitual, are capable of starting organic changes and genuine diseases. Man thinks, invents, loves, suffers, admires, and prays with his brains and all his organs." How true. And because it is true, the branch of medicine known as psychosomatics is based upon recognition of the interaction of thoughts and emotions upon the physical body of man. All this demonstrates the importance both of a study of the human mind and of the development of the power to control our thoughts. So the first effect of thought is upon the thinker, to change him into the likeness of that of which he thinks. Now we come to the second observed effect of thought upon the thinker, which is to form a habit. Habits are very, very important, aren't they? They are formed by the repetition of one kind of thought, the continued experience of one kind of sensation or emotion, and, of course, the constant expression of these in physical conduct. Together, these three, repeated thought, feeling, and action, these three form a habit. If the repetition continues long enough, the habit can become stronger than the man and force him into its indulgence. Can we change and conquer that? If so, how is the improvement to be brought about? By the right use of the formative power of thought. Thought power is the major means whereby a change of habit may be achieved. What's the method? Well, before I suggest it, let us see in further detail how habits come to be formed. Most habitual action has been preceded by habitual thought. When the two, action and thought, are continually performed, a brain path, or should we say a nerve path, leading to the motor centers, is cut by the thought energy which is employed. A kind of groove is cut, like a gramophone groove. Then, the next time the thought of performing the action arises, a weaker impulse, a smaller amount of energy, will travel over this path, which by now is already marked out. For the resistance and the inertia of the body have become somewhat reduced. This weaker impulse is all that is now necessary to cause one to act, to carry out the desire or the idea. Eventually, if one isn't careful, as this process is repeated often enough, the nerve cells in the brain and nervous system become so well organized and unified that the resultant act or behavior becomes almost automatic. That is good for good habits, but can be very dangerous for bad ones. When the mental body is watched by means of trained supersensory power, it is discovered that this formation of habits by constant repetition also occurs in that vehicle of man, which is built of mind stuff. Every time we think, we make a change in our mind-body, establish a tendency to vibrate at the same rate more easily next time. This continues until both physical and mental bodies have become habituated to the pursuance of a certain idea, to follow a particular line of thought, leading to physical conduct. In this way, then, habits are formed, and as some of us have found, they can become very strong indeed. Such deeply ingrained habits of an undesirable nature can seriously affect the health, the happiness, and the progress in life of those who become their victims. Well then, can well-established habits which are undesirable, can they be broken? Of course they can. And let me share with you the theosophical teaching about the curing of bad habits, their eradication. Well, the way of self-reformation is to form a new and good habit, to think about a new and desirable act. One should not concentrate too much upon conquering the old, the existing habits. If you think too much about them, you're feeding them, you see. One should rather concentrate on developing the opposite virtues, whatever they may be. Find the opposite virtue and fill your mind with that, and it will crowd the undesirable vice out of existence. Self-cure, then, consists of a reverse operation of the same process by which the original habit was formed. Constant mental repetition of the desired quality implants it in the mind and in the brain, and eventually it becomes so well established in both mind and brain that it crowds the old undesirable habit out of existence. So, you see, by concentrating our thought upon them, we can build quality after quality, virtue after virtue, power after power into the very fabric of our character. For such is one part of the mysterious power of the human mind. Every weakness, you know, contains its opposite power. And we needn't be unduly distressed by strong desires, for applying this knowledge, we can make flowers out of apparent weeds, rainbows out of seeming darknesses, and triumphs out of frustrations. Do you remember that amusing remark of Emerson? He said, "A weed is a plant the virtues of which have not yet been discovered." This theosophical guidance in the eradication of bad habits is not only important just as knowledge, it is also of great practical value. For if we are not careful, you know, irritation and anger can develop into sheer bad-temperedness. And bad-temperedness, on occasion, can mount into a veritable white rage. If we are wise, then, we will use our thought power to overcome such harmful and even dangerous tendencies. And this is achieved by redirecting into constructive channels the destructive energy of such emotions as irritability and anger. After all, isn't it rather foolish to get angry? To be angry when things can't be helped only makes them worse. To be angry when people disagree with your views is to discredit the worth of those views. To be angry when your conscience tells you you're in the wrong is to fight a losing battle. Therefore, it's a good thing, isn't it, to conquer anger. And this is done by using these teachings of theosophy concerning the two observed facts of thought upon the thinker. These are, you will remember, I've just been saying, first, to turn him temporarily into the likeness of that upon which he thinks, and the second, if long continued, is to form a habit. Good habits and good character are formed by right thinking. And that means constructive, harmonious thinking, and by concentration upon the qualities of character which we want to build into our nature. Now, let us look at those other effects. The two of the four effects of the action of human thought. We've considered two upon the thinker. Let us see what happens outside of him. At once we discover how telepathy works, whether in people who've trained themselves in thought transference or accidentally. Here it is found that the human mind is indeed a mental broadcaster and receiver. Every time we think, we send out a definite energy, which by mental vision can be observed as a force rushing out from the mind and brain in mento-electrical waves. These waves of thought force, very powerful they can be, these waves of thought force are vibrating on the characteristic frequencies of both the thinker and the type of thought which is occupying the mind. If one is thinking only generally, then the thought waves, travelling with the speed of light, go out equally in all directions. How far do they go? Well, the distance to which thought waves travel depends upon the intensity and the clarity of the thought and the degree and length of time of concentration upon it. The longer and the stronger the thought process, the further the waves of thought force will travel, quite naturally, of course. If, however, we are thinking of some definite place or person, then a kind of beam radio effect, thought radio, of the beam character comes into operation. In that case, most of the thought energy is concentrated upon the recipient. Such is the theosophical explanation of telepathy, to which I referred at the beginning. Simply put, it works like this. Thought transference is brought about by the generation of a thought energy which travels from the brain and the mind of the thinker into those of the recipient. And since everyone sends out quite strong thought impulses every time they think, consciously or unconsciously, we are all continuously influencing the thought, the character, yes, and the very conduct of other people. The great importance of thought control and speech control now becomes obvious, doesn't it? As I've already said, I think it's worth repeating. Private opinion creates public opinion. Public opinion overflows eventually into national behavior. And national behavior, as things are now, can make or mar the world. That, I think, is why private opinions, thoughts and feelings, and especially conversation expressing them, are so extremely important. Whilst others can be helped and healed by thought power, and indeed they can, at the same time it's true that grave harm can be wrought by evil thought. So we do well, don't we, to watch our thoughts and these mysterious powers, this electro-mental energy of our minds. We do well to nurture our minds with great thoughts. As Disraeli said in his book Cydonia, to believe in the heroic makes heroes. That's rather a splendid and brief way of putting it. To believe in the heroic makes heroes. We must remember also not only ourselves, but that inevitably other people are similarly affected by our thought. And that is the one of the two effects of thinking outside of the thinker. The other one is a little beyond our range of thought and time together just now. It is to create thought forms. Each time we think, we make in mental matter, mind stuff, an appropriate form. I can't go into that just now, I'm sorry to say. It's a fascinating subject. Theosophical literature, however, provides much information upon thought forms. Now, here is a closing suggestion about the use of our minds. In these days of strain, hurry, and tension, it is very valuable to form the habit of taking 10 minutes or quarter of an hour every day alone in mental and physical quietude. We may withdraw our thoughts from the external, ever-changing demands upon us and the physical world, and fix them strongly upon the very highest and noblest subjects, the great interior and eternal truth. One such truth upon which it is good to meditate each day if we can, and also to keep constantly somewhere at the back of our minds. One such truth is that of the omnipresence of God. the divine power, life, and consciousness of the whole universe and also within man. By dwelling in thought upon the divine presence without and within us, it is possible to attain to a serenity of mind and actually to come to know by personal, direct experience that the power and the life of God are everywhere around us, sustaining, supporting, vivifying us if we will only keep in touch with them, and that they are also within us. That indeed, underneath us all, as the saying goes, underneath are the everlasting arms. In one of our quiet, daily quiet times, we might well repeat and meditate upon the words of the poet with which I will now close. Speak to him, thou, for he hears, and spirit with spirit can meet. Closer is he than breathing, and nearer than hands and feet. Do you notice how quietening, calming those beautiful words are? And the same is true of other texts, and it's quite a good thing to make a habit of collecting them, ready for meditation, each morning perhaps, and to hold in thought during the day. Shall I repeat those words once again? They're from that poem called The Higher Pantheon by Tennyson. Speak to him, thou, for he hears, and spirit with spirit can meet. Closer is he than breathing, and nearer than hands and feet.